And we'll be talking as well to Philip King, he of The South Wind Blows, and it's blowing quite strongly today, and also Theo Dorgan of Poetry Ireland. They're here. In fact, we're not going to a break because of a technical problem with the break. But I'm happy to say, as I mentioned, that I'm joined in studio by Theo and Philip. And it was, in fact, just 1 year ago tomorrow when the Nobel laureate Seamus Heaney passed away. Frequently referred to as Ireland's finest poet since Yeats, this literary genius who hailed from a small farm in County Derry remained grounded despite his global fame. Theo Dorgan and Philip King, you're both very welcome to studio. But let's listen first briefly to Seamus Heaney talking about how he first discovered his poetic voice.
Well, I was lucky that something wakened up in me through reading. I mean, reading brought me alive, and then I found that I could bring myself alive sometimes through writing. And I wobbled to and fro. I don't know quite. I thought that when I've said this so often, I kind of still believe it, but it's been said often by me. It was when I wrote this poem, Digging, that I felt I was onto a sound. I'd come onto a beam. I had got the wedge into a grain, and the grain was splitting open right down the right way. And that had to do with the fact that my own voice somehow, I mean my physical voice, the sound and cadences and stresses that I would have made speaking, somehow when I looked and listen to what was on the page, it was there.
And that's Seamus Heaney talking about how he discovered that voice. Theo Dorgan, I know you've long since moved on from Poetry Ireland, but he really was, I suppose, somebody who, and this isn't an original comment, but extraordinary and ordinary at the same time.
Well, I think he managed to straddle the two worlds, and his explanation would be that he understood his luck. He could say, if Hugh McDiarmid hadn't chosen the title for his autobiography, Seamus could have written an autobiography and called it Lucky Poet. He understood that it was fortune. Fortune singled him out. Fortune gave him the gift. Fortune gave him his background, and fortune gave him the whole world to walk in. And he always considered it fortune. When he won the Nobel, I remember him saying that, and people were taxing him. Lots of people were taxing him with doing too much, with acceding to too many requests to be this, that and the other thing.
He was tremendously accessible, wasn't he?
And he said, when you have a good harvest, you have to share it with the neighbours. And I think he felt that whatever he'd planted, the sun came out, the rain came out, all in their due seasons and times, and he had that harvest.
And that suggests, Philip King, an absolute grounding in his rural background. That sense of place, I suppose, was always important to him.
Hugely important to him. And just reading Tom McCarthy's piece in The Examiner, talking about Seamus a year after his tragic death, he said, "When a great poet dies, the tide goes out a very long way. Even a year after his death, the light from Heaney's prodigious star still illuminates our Irish tides." And it's so, so true. He had a real sense of the extraordinary, the marvellous, as he called it. And he had a great sense of the ordinary as well, and a great warmth for it. Where I live, right at the edge of the Dingle Peninsula, look out over to the Blasket Islands, there's a body of water there between the extremity of the peninsula and the first Blasket Island. And out of that water came a tune, a wonderful tune called Port in the Bouquet. And the story goes that the boatmen were out one evening and they came back in. Somebody took down an instrument and began to play this tune. And somebody said, "Where did you get it?" And they said, "Well, we got it outside." And it was, so what do you mean? He said, it was given up and it was given to us. And Seamus wrote a poem called The Given Note.
Yep.
About that. And it's just such a fantastic thing. And it really encapsulates what he believed himself, the business of sharing, the business of not owning anything really, but the thing that is in common ownership, that is owned by us all,
I
think enriching and powerful.
We may actually be able to hear Seamus Heaney reciting The Given Note.
The Given Note. On the most westerly blasket, in a dry stone hut, he got this air out of the night. Strange noises were heard by others who followed, bits of a tune coming in on loud weather, though nothing like melody. He blamed their fingers and ear as unpracticed, their fiddling easy, for he had gone alone into the island and brought back the whole thing. The house throbbed like his full violin. So whether he calls it spirit music or not, I don't care.
he took it out of wind off mid-Atlantic. Still he maintains, from nowhere. It comes off the bow gravely, rephrases itself into the air.
No substitute for the man himself reading it, Philip King.
Absolutely not, but I just love that line. So whether he calls it spirit music or not, I don't care. He took it out of wind, off mid-Atlantic. And that's the thing, you know, he was a teacher, he was a sharer, and his generosity was really, really fantastic. And that business of the given note, the thing that's given, as I said earlier on, the thing that's shared, the thing that's ours, that's not entailed, that we have for ourselves and we give to each other with generosity, this is something that is really priceless and beyond value. He understood that. And as we gather in various different places this weekend, where people will, you know, go to Croke Park, go to the match in Limerick, go to Stradbally, go to the Aran Islands where Theo is going. There'll be gatherings up of people all around the country who will exchange notes of music, who will exchange words and argue.
And memories of Seamus given the weekend Seamus, that's yeah. in it.
And
I mean, I always touch on just since that one of the most moving things the whole time when Seamus died was after the minute silence in Croke Park. It was an enormous volley of applause and it was led off from the hill. And I thought that was an extraordinary moment, that that applause was led off not from the dear seats and the stands, but from the hill.
He was the kind of the national Uncle Seamus, wasn't he?
He was more than that. I think he challenged us to remember what's best in ourselves. In that line there in the given note, he talks about rephrases itself into air. There is still something in our hearts and minds in this country that values what's true and what values what's true in language. And I have no patience with those small minds and those pygmy minds that talk about how Seamus didn't deal with the world as it is. He dealt with nothing else. He dealt with the real world we actually live in. He didn't obey journalistic imperatives. He didn't obey tribal imperatives. He listened to the voice of who we are when we're at our best and how we'd like to be. And he wrote those poems. He wrote them out of our lives and for our lives.
Yes, and he said that the aim of poetry and the poet is finally to be of service, to ply the effort of the individual into the larger world of community as a whole.
We want to hear again the voice of Seamus Heaney, who died a year ago tomorrow. But first, we have to take that break we missed earlier.
From time to time, everyone has to face difficulties in their life. If you're going through one of those times right now, talk to a solicitor. You'll get sound advice from someone who's in your corner. Someone you know you can trust to protect your interests. And someone who can ensure that you're provided with access to justice. With unique knowledge and experience, it's just one of the many ways your solicitor can help you. Talk to your solicitor from the Law Society of Ireland.
Dear Bill, we've been together for years, but I can't stand so much about you, like your constant moping around the kitchen table. So I'm leaving you for Electric Ireland's pay-as-you-go electricity. It's the best in the market. With just one call to 1850 305 095, I can now save and control my way. So long, Bill.
Break up with your electricity bill with the best one-year pay-as-you-go electricity offer nationwide. Call Electric Ireland at 1850 305 095 and say good riddance to the electricity bill in your life. Electric Ireland, Ireland's energy.
Strange sounds by way of separators on the breaks today. Anyway, we move on and we continue with our conversation about Seamus Heaney with Theo Dorgan and Philip King. Theo, there was that collection in 1984, Station Island, and I want you to talk in a few moments, about a particular poem, but we want to listen to it first, Making Strange.
Making Strange. I stood between them, the one with his travelled intelligence and tawny containment, his speech like the twang of a bowstring, and another, unshorn and bewildered in the tubs of his Wellingtons, smiling at me for help, faced with this stranger I'd brought him. Then a cunning middle voice came out of the field across the road, saying, "Be adept and be dialect. Tell of this wind coming past the zinc hut. Call me sweetbriar after the rain or snowberries cooled in the fog. But love the cut of this travelled one and call me also the cornfield of Boaz. Go beyond what's reliable in all that keeps pleading and pleading, these eyes and puddles and stones, and recollect how bold you were when I visited you first with departures you cannot go back on. A chaffinch flicked from an ash, and next thing I found myself driving the stranger through my own country, adept at dialect, reciting my pride in all that I knew, that began to make strange at that same recitation.
Making Strange by Seamus Heaney, Theo.
Yeah, I love that poem because it rehearses and resolves the dilemma that he found himself in. Seamus was that generation, especially of Catholics in the North, who came out of the Butler Education Act in 1947, just as the O'Malley introduction to free education introduced an entire generation of Irish poets to the universities. Seamus and his contemporaries got to the universities then. And that makes for an alienation. You're immediately cut off from your background mm-hmm. by your education. Mm-hmm. And it's one of the dilemmas that people who aspire to have their children educated as well as possible often have to face. But the difficulty for Seamus is that he comes out of his own place, four square, standing there up to the ankles in the ground of Ballaghy, and yet his head is in a higher air. His head is in London, his head is in Harvard, his head is in New York. And so he has to negotiate. He has to negotiate the truth of where he comes from and the truth of where he actually lives. And the trick is not to become Thomas More and become sentimental. The trick is to tell the truth. And he does that. He does that by understanding what's strange about both worlds. And that's where the language takes him, the idea that everything, in some sense, is strange but can be made familiar. And that's his duty. That's his political duty, his human duty, his family duty to himself is actually duty to language. And one of the things that made him so beloved, I stood outside the Sacred Heart Church in Donnybrook a year ago tomorrow, mm-hmm. and I tried to explain to Enda Kenny why this bewilderingly mixed crowd was there, struck in genuine grief, and said, "This is Ireland. This is the real Republic, where language matters, where poetry matters, where hurling matters, where football matters, where the music that Philip is going down to tomorrow in Stradbally matters, where the Kerry Mayo replay matters. This is who we really are. We are a culture, not an economy. We are a culture." Mm-hmm. And Seamus was a shining light in that possible republic of whom we might yet be.
Philip? You worked with him as well, making films and documentaries and that.
Yeah, I mean, I have the book that he signed for me here. It's a very precious thing. Back in 1999, we were making a film called The Poet and the Piper, Keeping Time, with Seamus and with Liam O'Flynn. And he was very connected to the world of music. But he was like a bonding agent, really. And he was something, as Theo has just said, who brought the people of the country together. And they were united in grief, as Theo said, this day or tomorrow last year, when he passed away. And one thing that he wrote as well, he said, "I can't think of a case where poetry changed the world. What poetry does is change people's understanding of what is going on in the world." And if we were having this conversation 100 years ago, at the beginnings of this decade of commemorations that we're going to commemorate now, in 1914, the tumult of the Great War, looking at his poem about Ledwich the other night, I was reminded of it.
And Edward Thomas and Khaki.
The people that were around, the people who were giving voice to what an Irish state might or could be, were all cultural figures one way or another. And, you know, the GAA was mentioned, you know, Conradh na Gaeilge, Yeats, Singh, Lady Gregory, 100 years on.
And the only businessman we remember is William Martin Murphy, and with no affection, certainly on my part.
Okay, just let's hear one last clip from Seamus Heaney, this time talking about these suggestions that he might have been dithering, pardon me, about the subject of Northern Ireland.
"My sense of the thing is that I feel both sides of the thing very clearly, you know. I can understand the stasis of the North immensely. Because I grew up in it. Every part of me is entirely, you know, almost every part of me is riddled with it, you know. So, I mean, I think that the whatever kind of dithering about that has gone on has to do with being not sidestepping it. I mean, a lot of people only learnt about it, you know, in about 1969-70. They have a kind of guide to it, but they don't have any geology of it, you know. So I think people who grew up in the North, they are geologically, archaeologically, their personalities are full of it, you know. And what they say and what they write presumes an intimacy with the underground of the language as well as the surface of it.
Seamus Heaney talking about Northern Ireland and his own attitude to it and his roots there. Finally, you're both heading in separate directions. Well, you're both going west, but you're stopping, I think, in Stradbally, Philip King. You're doing a special programme there on Sunday night.
Yes, RT Radio 1, my programme, The South Wind Blows, has gone from West Kerry to Stradbally, to the heart of the country. And artists will gather there, all sorts of various different artists of every different sort. And we'll be broadcasting live on Radio 1 at 9 o'clock until 11 o'clock. And we have a fantastic lineup of people. I just want to say one thing just finally about Seamus. You know, there is no point hoping for a better past. I think he gives us the motive force to look forward and to see what's possible. And every time I hear his voice, I am reminded of that possibility, and I thank him for it.
And Philip, you're going right out west. Sorry, I beg your pardon, Theo. I beg your pardon.
I think you're announced it's the Liam O'Flaherty Summer School. And I have to give a talk on it. I just came up with the title late last night, The Brutal, Purposeful Slaughter of the Poor. It's, as you might expect, it's about the First World War. Can I just thank the anonymous correspondent who wrote one of the papers the day after Seamus died, who said simply, "We're a man down." I thought that summed up perfectly the mood of the nation. We're a man down, but we'll stay in the ranks. We'll keep the line.
Such an Irish way of putting it. Isn't on it? That note, thank you both for coming in. Theo Dorgan, Philip King, back with The Gathering after the break.
Today with Sean O'Rourke on RTE Radio 1.
It's a family secret, so pay attention now. You crack the eggs into a bowl. It's important that you have flour on your hands and on the table. You don't make yeast like they used to. Don't just pour the batter any which way. The longer the bread cools, the better.
Grannies don't cut corners in the kitchen, but that doesn't mean you can't. Soane's Baking Mixes. Wholesome simplicity.
Those gentle summer breezes will soon turn into winter gales, so be prepared. Change now to secure premium quality Senator windows and stay warm right throughout the winter. Order 5 or more windows and we'll give you 50% off a new back door. Order 10 or more and get the door absolutely free. Plus get the equivalent of the VAT back with the Home Renovation Incentive Scheme. Call today on 1850 774455 or check out senatorwindows.ie.
Senator Windows.
Tweet at TodaySOR.
Now, a more focal score, as it were, about Seamus Heaney. A reminder, you can hear more about him on Radio 1 tomorrow. We're going to broadcast a two-part documentary series called Professor Heaney. It starts it's tomorrow week. It starts at 6 p.m. next Saturday, that's September the 6th. It explores Seamus Heaney's life as a teacher at Oxford and Harvard with interviews with fellow poets Andrew Motion, Blake Morrison, Tom Slay, amongst others. And as we say, we're going to have The South Wind Blows on Radio 1 on Sunday night from Electric Picnic. And we move on now, because the week gone by saw a lot of criticism of the GAA. Talk about one man down. No longer, though, in the case of Mayo. A lot of anger from Irish rail workers. Some kite flying from government figures on what may or may not be in Budget 2015. For a look back at these and other stories in studio, I am joined by Mary Mitchell O'Connor, Fine Gael TD for Dún Laoghaire. Michael Clifford is a columnist with the Irish Examiner. Mary Minahan is a political correspondent with the Irish Times, and Tony Foley, senior lecturer in economics at DCU's Business School. Mick Clifford, you're a Kerry man. This story, we're still more than 24 hours away from the replay. But what do you think of all that's been going on in the GAA in the last week?
It leaves an uneasy feeling, I think, Sean. I mean, you know, The commercial element of the association has to be observed, and bringing in the American football team for tomorrow's game wasn't a bad idea. I mean, the chances of a replay weren't high. No, a replay has occurred. I think that's where the issue arises. And where I have a problem with their commercial approach to the situation is that it seems that come hell or high water, Dublin, should they be in a replay? And remember, think of the odds of two draws and two semi-finals. They're reserving Croke Park for Saturday week on that basis. I think that's where the mistake was made. They should have had the Kerry Mayo replay for Saturday week. In the highly unlikely event that you have a second draw, Is there anything wrong with Clonus? I mean, I was there in 2001 when the Dubs went down to Turles. It was like the fall of Saigon down the M8. They didn't know where to go. But I mean, would there be any problem with that? And one other,
or even two separate matches cleared the stadium as they were going to do for Garth Brooks.
What about the players is the big thing. I think it was Darragh O'Shea this week said no player ever grew up dreaming that he'd be playing in the Gaelic rounds. And that's nothing against the Gaelic rounds. Have quarterfinals around the country, I'd suggest.
But I suppose, Tony Foley, to borrow a phrase from the economic discourse of recent times, they are where they are.
They are where they are. And I have a bit of sympathy as well, because I'm a Bowes fan myself, and we had a match cancelled because there was a little hole in the ground. So we're conscious of looking after pitches. I'm surprised that the GAA actually arranged the American football match for when it did, because even if there weren't any replays, you're using the pitch before a big match. So I'm surprised at the planning of it. But there is one positive side. I think it's good for Limerick. We should look at the side of it, that it's good to actually spread matches around, that we've come very Dublin centric. So it is good they spread. It would be nice if there was a replay with Dublin, as you say, that would be spread also, and Dublin wouldn't get special preference.
Mary Mitchell O'Connor, as a woman of the West who grew up close, I think, to the Mayo boundary, the county boundary, and you in the heart of Gaelic football country in County Galway, you probably appreciate the dilemmas that people are going through. But also, you were at Croke Park last Sunday, and I think you wanted to nominate a woman of the match.
I did, actually. I sat beside James Horan's wife, Mrs. Horan. Mayo manager's wife. And she was absolutely enthralled in the game. I observed her biting her nails. I was right beside her. But she was there with many of her children, and she was feeding her child, her little new baby, and she was looking after another little daughter and bringing them to the toilet. And when it was all over, you know, the look of shock on her face, my heart went out to her. So I actually nominate Mrs. Horan as man of the match, but I really want Mayo to win this weekend, and then probably Dublin, and I'll be conflicted then. Who will I go to? Who will I support for the All-Ireland?
Mary Minahan has the detached northern voice here.
Definitely no skin in the game for me, Sean. I mean, just any casual observer can see that, you know, the GAA has been at the centre of a lot of controversy over the Garth Brooks, the Sky deal, as I'm sure was observed to you following the death of Albert Reynolds, Sean. If he had still been in charge, we would have had 10 Garth Brooks concerts and there would be no questions asked about it. But, you know, seriously, I suppose there is a danger that the venue, Croke Park, is maybe becoming slightly more important than the organisation. You know, there's no doubt that it is a really positive revenue raiser for the GAA, but you know, the association's values are also very important. I've been listening to Ring is King, as we know, Michael Ring there from Mayo, and he certainly does have skin in the game. He made the suggestion that it could have been delayed for a week. I don't know if that would have knocked everything off. But
the most interesting Michael Ring said was that he made reference to another occasion when Mayo people had to go to Limerick in 1909, when a lot of them were held up along the road. I mean, there have been a few developments in motorised transport since 1909, I believe.
Okay, well, look, some of them obviously as a result of good budgets or capital programmes and all the rest of it. Michael Noonan hinted, as we know, earlier in the year that he might have some wriggle room, that they might be talking about a less than a 2 billion package overall between revenue raised and also added expenditure, Tony Foley. But kite flying, I think, has started to happen. We had comments from Jed Nash, the new Minister of State at the Department of Enterprise and Employment, talking about the need to have wage-led economic development, and also Minister of State Simon Harris talking about possible tax relief. So how are you reading things?
That's right. Well, it's bringing kite flying to a fine art. It's nearly satellite flying at this stage, that if we're to believe everything that's going to happen, we're going to get more budget for the health budget. We're going to get the tax bans reduced. We're going to get universal social charge reduced. We're going to get wage increases. Now, all of that's not going to happen because the money is still fairly tight. Because what we keep forgetting is that we're not 2 billion better off. It's just that it's 2 billion we don't have to borrow, or we don't have to cut, as it were. So various economists suggest there might be no adjustment needed in the budget to get to the 3% borrowing to up to 500 million. So if it's 500 million, the government is basically needing 500 million cuts to get its 3%. Now, we don't know the exact figures yet, but supposing it's 500 million, well, we have to find those cuts. And if on top of that we're going to have income tax reductions, we have to find the money. So it's not going to be as generous as maybe if we add up all this positive feeling suggests. Because if you look at just at some of the figures, we've about 2.2 million taxpayers in the country. Now, say, if they each got better off by about €5 a week, which is not enough to send us to the south of France and so on, that's going to cost almost 600 million. So if we're looking at €10 a week, it's over €1 billion, as it were. So it's very large amounts of money when you spread it all over. Even the cost of the universal social charge, the suggestions of reducing the universal social charge. But if the top one went from 7 to 6, that's 400 million. If we took 1% off all of the three bands, we're looking at a cost of much greater than that. We're looking at a cost of about 700 million. So we don't know how much money the government will have. And I suspect they'll probably end up with an income tax package of around 500, 600, 700 million. So we're looking at the average of €5 to €7 a week.
That's if everybody gets something. But Mary, yeah. Mitchell O'Connor, maybe, or do you think he should prioritise certain people?
You mean the Minister of Finance? Yes, of course. And that's what he will be doing. But as my colleague here said, you know, we haven't the September figures in. So we have no definites. Of course, we have our Minister Harris and Minister Jed Nash out. And I think they're creating conversations. And I suppose as a local TD, you know, people will tell me on the doorstep what they think about kind of what the suggestions are from the minister. But look, it's no big surprise because my Minister Noonan has said, and it's on the record, that he will reduce the whole public, you know, tax, that he thinks it's very, very burdensome and that we need to look at it. But look, let's make no mistake about it. We are not going to write checks. We are going to make sure that everything that we bring in will be to create job creation, put more money into people's pockets so that they can go out and spend. And I suppose if I can just say locally, I'm hearing this. I'm hearing it in Dunleary, in our town, Sean. Dunleary, the bids initiative. I'm hearing it. I've met with Sandyford. They're going to have a big, huge gateway launch. So it is trickling down, but we are not. This is not checkbook politics. Someone mentioned, you know, what would happen in the past if such a one was Taoiseach. This is not going to happen on our watch.
Of course, Mary Mahon, the only people taking out their checkbooks that we know about at the moment are the people who are going to be getting those bills for water and having to pay them from the 1st of October. I know the bill isn't going to arrive until January and we're still making up for Christmas. But probably not surprising that they have to start making some comforting noises about how things might be alleviated.
That's it. I mean, I for one am delighted that these conversations are happening because the humble political correspondent can feel a bit like the, you know, the lonely cabin boy in the Mary Celeste around Dáil Éireann. It's been very quiet, so I'm not entirely surprised that people like Simon Harris, who I interviewed, and Jed Nash are coming out. But there's a little bit of danger in raising expectations like this about the budget. I mean, there's a risk that people will be remarkably underwhelmed when Minister Noonan does stand up in October and make his announcement. Of course, the point that they're making is there are going to be two more budgets if this government runs its full course. And I suppose Labour and Fine Gael, the two parties, need to be distinctive and have a separate voice without destabilising or unsettling the coalition.
Mick Clifford, there is this budget and then only one more, though, before the encounter with the electorate. So what do you think they are going to be thinking?
Yeah,
they'll have to start thinking some political as well as economic thoughts.
Yeah, right. You'd have to wonder, are they thinking too much political rather than economic at this stage because of how close the next election is? And I worry also that whatever, first of all, they have already set expectations. I mean, I think it's inevitable now that unless there's relative giveaway, I mean, the way Tony was talking about, if you were to knock them a couple of percent off the USC, unless you have something like that now, people will be underwhelmed, I think, at this stage, because they've already raised those expectations. And the other issue is, where exactly, if there are going to be cuts, are they going to direct them? Are they going to be at the electorate, which proportionately would contain more better off people than, say, taxpayers in general or society at large, because better off people vote far more? And if so, that's going to be an issue as well, and that's going to be socially going to be a bit of a problem around that.
It's all about raising expectations. We'll talk about some of the conflict arising from those raised expectations after the break.